Hi, you beautiful people. You've just all been so wonderful since I first arrived, given me so much of your love and your warmth and your friendship. I've met many old friends, and I'm having the opportunity, and we've got two more wonderful days, to make many more new friends. And this is a cherished experience. I don't know about you, but I am always just a wee bit happier living my day at a time, if I have something in the future to look forward to. It doesn't spoil my day at a time, it adds to it. And I have looked forward to this for 14 months. And you know, it isn't always that you look forward to something for a long time, and it turns out to meet your expectations. And this, of course, will come as no surprise to you. This is far beyond my wildest expectations. It is just wonderful. I asked Jim this morning how come this event is this particular weekend. And he gave me, in his nice way, the answer to my question, and it was a very natural kind of an answer. This was the weekend that the facility was available. That makes good sense. But the reason I asked was because, as I thought about it, realizing that 6 days from now is Thanksgiving, I felt that how very timely it was for me, and I think perhaps for you too, to be here as we start our very special season of thanks. And I have so much. I feel so very full this Thanksgiving time. I want to share it with you. But before I do that, let me go back and tell you a little about me, and then perhaps you'll see why I feel the way I do, and how I came to be here at all. First of all, my name is Midge McFadden, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Milburn, New Jersey group, and a staff member at GSO. And I'm very, very grateful for both of those things. I always want to remember that I'm an alcoholic, because if I should forget that, all the wonderful things that are mine or that I'm part of are gone. I'm nothing. So my name doesn't matter. Nothing about me really matters, except the simple, uncomplicated fact that I am an alcoholic. And thank God, and I'm very grateful that I know that. Some people say they became alcoholic with their first drink, that they drank alcoholically from the beginning. I am not one of those. I know now that I was literally a sitting duck for alcoholism, because I had my first drink at 16, but before that time and at that time, I was very, very quiet. Some of you find that hard to believe. The next thing you'll find even harder. I couldn't communicate with anybody, my contemporaries or adults. I felt like an odd stick. I felt out of it. When I was forced to go to school dances, I spent my time holding up the wall and wishing I could go through it. I was awkward, gawky, freckle-faced. My mother, for years, had called me her ugly duckling. The name fit very well, but it hurt. It hurt desperately. And this did nothing to help the self-esteem of a very, very shaky teenager. But be that as it may, at 16, at a home party, my dad gave me my first cocktail glass. I'd had sips before and probably had about as much as a cocktail in going the rounds, but at 16, I'd outgrown this. So I was allowed to have a glass of my own to hold in my own hand. What happened was very interesting. I only had that one cocktail glass, and I don't know what was in it, except it was pink and a little sweet. I enjoyed it very much. It was cold. I liked the taste of it. It was a little fruity. I was fruity, too. But I liked the taste of it. But then, something happened. The next thing I knew, I'm going around talking to people. And I'm laughing, and this was unheard of, to laugh out loud. And the miracle of the ages happened when someone else laughed. One of Daddy's professional friends laughed at something I said. And this had never happened. And I thought this was great. And so when I went to bed that night, in going over the events of the afternoon, I realized that for the first time in my memory, I had felt comfortable with people. I had felt at ease. I know I didn't go around all afternoon hanging my head so they couldn't see my face. I forgot I was ugly, and I put my head right up. I had enjoyed myself. I had enjoyed the people. For the first time in my life, I had been a little outgoing. I had given a little. Aha, I had it. This was the magic. Now I knew how I was going to be able to function. And I functioned this way for many years. Every time I went out socially, I always managed to see that I went where there was alcohol. I drank my full share of it. I became, in short order, the girl with the hollow leg. I was never the girl who was sick or the girl that had to be taken home. I took other people home. And so from having no claim to fame whatsoever, I finally prided myself on the amount I could drink. And when the day came, and it did, that I could drink most men, apparently there weren't any alcoholic men in that circle, I could drink most men under the table while I walked away. I thought this was really something. I look back at my thinking then now with shame. Because to think that a late teenage, early 20s girl thinks that this is the big deal in life is a pretty sad commentary on that girl that was me. That is the way I thought. It will come as no surprise whatsoever to know that I finally married a man who drank. And he drank more than I did. I married in 1942, and this was in the very early years of World War II. As wars go on now, we really have to, you know, specify which one. He was with what had been a National Guard outfit from Massachusetts, and was then supposedly protecting Mare Island, the coast of California, from a darling little inland town right across the bridge from Vallejo. A lovely little town full of lovely people who drank a lovely lot of liquor. They were very grateful to these boys. Now, how they got any protection from these boys, I will never know. Because I knew where to find any one of them most any time. And it wasn't up there on the hill with those anti-aircraft guns. It was right down in the local gin mill. But be that as it may, I was away from home, I was away from school, I was away from I was married now, I was my own girl, and I could come and go as I pleased, and I could drink as I wanted to, and everything was great. Plus the fact a husband who drank more than I did, and this was a wonderful life, and I really enjoyed it. I did only crazy things then, like wanting to go into the park and go on the swings at 2 o'clock in the morning. I did not do things that caused me any trouble. If I caused anybody else any, they didn't tell me. And I couldn't cause him any trouble. Because he passed out before he knew what I was doing anyway. And at that point, I was young enough. I had a very good job, too. I was secretary to the commanding officer of Benicia Arsenal. And I was young enough so that I could take a cold Coke in the morning and go on about my work and muddle through the day, really. But adequately, apparently, I didn't get fired. And then start in another round the next night. And if my husband had to be on duty at night, that was perfectly all right. Didn't make any difference. There were plenty of his buddies that were only too glad to take me out drinking. I never caused him any trouble. I had a good time. And we didn't have to pay for our drinks. This was the nice part. You could go in there the night before payday. And for anybody on an Army sergeant's pay, you know what the night before payday's like. You don't even eat. They know that he's not drinking. But we could go into one of these two gin mills they had there the night before payday. And say, hi, glad to see you. Have a drink. These grateful townspeople. And you could leave. And I have left and gone in with no money at all and come out with $1.15 change. We moved from there and went on for a stint in El Paso. I got into a little bit of trouble there because I got mixed up trying to drink with the Air Force. And I finally learned I better go back to the Army. I could manage that, but that Air Force was really something. But actually, there was no great trouble, except my husband was getting quite sick, and I didn't know what was the matter with him. I was really worried about him. And I blamed it on the pressure he was under, which was really considerable. And didn't have to consider it any more than that. The Army wasn't seeming to worry about it, so he told me that there was no great need for me to worry about it. And so then we went to Houston. Houston was a wonderful experience for me, and it's one of my favorite towns in this whole world. But while we were there, I spent the summers down in the Gulf Coast, right by the Army camp. And then in the winter, I spent in Houston and worked. And then my husband went overseas, European theater. And I was so happy in Houston, and I was living with such a nice family of a mother and two grown daughters, that I chose to stay there. And I loved my job. So there I stayed. And now all the social life was gone. My husband had left. I was living in a completely female home. And I really had no social life of my own. And no way to create any that I thought was so-called legal. I took this bit as being a war widow very, very seriously. As a matter of fact, I was a little drippy about it. A little obnoxious about it. And I well recall there was a girl in the office where I worked whose husband was also over fighting the Battle of the Bulge, except she was dating. She was going out for dinner and so forth. And I thought, oh, my Janie. Oh, isn't that terrible? Oh, my goodness. Nice little wives don't do that. Oh, her husband wouldn't like that. And I was very prissy and very, you know, pleased with myself for the way I was conducting myself. As I brought a jug of wine home from work with me and took it in my room and sat in a rocking chair in the evening, drinking the wine, listening to, Glenn Miller, Guy Lombardo, so forth, on the radio, and writing letters, finishing my nightly letter, and then crying. I thought I had every justification in the world for the way I was drinking. I could see nothing wrong. Not only could I see nothing wrong with my drinking alone every night this way, I didn't look at it. I was too busy looking at what somebody else was doing and criticizing what somebody else was doing to take the time to look at me. I didn't know then what I know now. I couldn't afford to look at me. I was not a nice thing to look at then. And I didn't want to look at me and my behavior. And there were plenty of things I could have been doing those evenings besides what I really chose to do. But I wouldn't have told you then I chose to do it. After the war, My husband came back, and meantime, I just before the end of the war, before he came back, I had gone back to Boston. My mother was not well, and she very much wanted me to come home, so I did. I went back to Boston and was living there when he returned, and then we set up a small home of our own, an apartment, and I had thought that once we settled down to normal living and got over this wartime marriage bit, that things were going to change. I knew I was drinking too much. Of course, most of all, I knew he was drinking too much. So I would, you know, give the ultimatum, and we'd both stop drinking so much. Not stop drinking, and there is a difference. But I never made my speech. One day went on after another, and I continued my regular pattern of drinking, and so did he. We both had jobs. A doctor had told me that I would never have children. We discussed adoption and decided against it. I finally said, well, there are people, I suppose, who don't have children or who are happy. We'll make our lives in a different direction. This was a heartbreaking thing to me when I was told this. And you know what happened? Next month I was pregnant. That pregnancy lasted for 6 months. Just a few days over 6 months. And early one Sunday morning, I was rushed to the hospital and had two little boys. Not one, but two. This was very exciting to me. I was quite thrilled. All my life, things had gone along very much the way that I wanted them to. I had had many, many good and nice things in my life. And really, there was no reason I wasn't going to have this. It didn't enter my head until the doctor came into my room. And he said, you may not see them. Yes, you heard the rumor correctly. There are two. I was awake at the moment. I knew there were two. But you can't see them. Don't get your hopes up. They have a million to one chance to live for 24 hours. Well, I believed him. I've always believed doctors, and I believed him. And he was a very dear friend, and he would tell me nothing but the truth, and I knew he didn't want to hurt me. And he was trying to be gentle, but that kind of news is never gentle. And he left my room, and I was alone. And I can remember so well, I thought, how can I get this? It can't be bought. Their lives can't be bought. I can't con it. Daddy can't help me. There's only one thing left. And I had been a church-going girl most of my life. But that morning I prayed with everything in me. And I promised God that if I could keep those babes, I would be the best mother that I could possibly be. There was not enough arrogance in me to say the best mother in the world. Even then, I said the best mother I could possibly be. Well, those babes live, and what a joy they have been. Just wonderful, wonderful boys. But the important part of this is, I think that every parent, this is highlighted, there is a drama to it because of the incidents of their birth. It was touch and go for a long time. But I think every parent feels exactly the same way at the birth of every child. And for an alcoholic parent, man or a woman, mother or father, I think we go through a very special kind of hell when we are drinking, because we know, I knew I was not living up to what I wanted. Never mind what they wanted or what anybody else wanted, but what I wanted. It was quite some time before my drinking really interfered with the children because they became my life. Of necessity, they had to because I had no help. And these two preemies came home from the hospital Christmas Eve day, 5 pounds apiece, in doll's clothing. And put in the same crib at home. You couldn't even have two cribs for them, one on one end and one on the other. And I didn't know how to take care of them. I didn't know what to do with them. I was frightened to death. But we did manage to get through the first year. Much sickness. They were isolated a good deal of the time, and I was isolated with them. But we got through the first year. And there had to be another tragedy. Or a tragedy. That one certainly wasn't. That one worked out. But there was a tragedy. When the boys were two, their father died with what I know now was an alcoholic suicide. I didn't know what it was then. I had never heard a cross word from this man. He loved the boys. He loved me, as far as I knew. He was a wonderful father and a good husband. And all of a sudden, he wasn't there. He was in the garage. Alcoholism is a very strange illness. I believe that it is going to progress within the system of its victim when it's ready, and that outside circumstances of one's life, the things we blame, really have nothing to do with it. And this proved to be so in my life, because after this tragedy, when I was really very bitter, very resentful. How could he do this to me? I didn't give a thought then to the tormented mind that had been driven to this act. How could he do this to me and to the children? What am I going to do? How am I going to manage? But strangely enough, my drinking pattern didn't change. I was a daily drinker. I was then drinking every day. I didn't change my drinking one single bit because there was something more important to me than the next drink, and that was my love for and responsibility to these two little boys. Somehow I had to work out the problem. But you see, there was something else. Alcoholism had not progressed to compulsive drinking in me, and so I could do it. Had this been 5 years later, the story would have been different. I know that now. But I did go through the next few months on the same, really, kind of an even keel, you know, sort of a mode state most of the time. But I got through it, I functioned, I did take care of the kids, I didn't get a job because I had to stay home and take care of them. And this was my problem. How am I going to go out to work and support them, and how am I going to stay here and take care of them? And I took care of that very nicely. I got married. I met a very, very fine man. Now, some of you know that my husband, because I've spoken, some of you have asked about him, I've said this, he works for the Veterans Administration. Now, if you can just add this up into my story, maybe you can make the connection. But anyway, that's exactly what happened. I went in there, I was a widow of 1 week, and I went in there to the VA to see how I stood and what the insurance was and all the things you have to go through. And I went in there to take care of those things. And a very, very nice man, so helpful and so kind, took care of me. And he said, you know, you don't live too far from me. You're just in the next town. And with those little kids to take care of, I hate to see you coming all the way in town. So you don't have to bother to come back here next week to sign those papers. I'll bring them to you. And so he did. And he kept bringing papers and all kinds of things, toys. And so we were married. And John has been just a wonderful stepfather to those boys, and he gave us a nice home, and he just did absolutely great. But I can't stand prosperity, because it wasn't too long after that marriage. You see, I had married a bachelor of 35 who had always said he had no use for women or kids, and his family were very surprised. He's not an alcoholic. They were very surprised when he turned up with a wife who was a widow with twin boys 3 years old. But I don't know how I would have managed this, bringing them up, particularly in view of what happened without John. He was really the greatest. But all of a sudden, the drinking pattern changed. And very soon, I was drinking wine all day long. He liked to drink, but he was not an alcoholic. He can only drink so much, and he wants to have a glass of milk and a piece of chocolate cake. So I don't think we have to worry about him for a while. And he also liked to go to bed early. And in those days, that was great, because I'd sit there, watch television, and then I could bring the bottle in beside me. You know, put one hand over one eye and try to watch television and drink. It wasn't too long before what was the worst part of alcoholism, active alcoholism to me, started to set in. And like everything, it's so insidious, you didn't notice it for a while. But it's the withdrawal from people, the withdrawal from going to church, the withdrawal from going to PTA. Now, I really liked these things. I had enjoyed them very much, and I had friends in these various places. Withdrawal from the community. We had a lot of gals around this sort of young marriage group, and we had a wonderful time. Until I decided one by one they were talking about me. And when my husband would come home at night, I'd tell him the most terrible lies, as I could invent them, about each different girl as I was cutting her off. Well, the reason I was cutting her off was because she had either called me or tried to come to the house that day. I was drunk, or I wanted to continue drinking. I didn't want her. Or my house looked like alcoholic lives here, and I was ashamed, and I didn't want her. So I had to say something about her. I couldn't talk about me. And as far as my husband concerned, he thought the house was immaculate if I dusted the top of the television set. I could do that drunk. My real suffering was about the children. I discovered it. I knew this when I was drinking, and I couldn't stop it. It seemed to me that everything, every sentence I started out of those little boys started with the word go. Go out to play. Go upstairs. Go watch television. Of course, it had to start with go. I had to get them out of my way because the bottle was right here in the kitchen, or if it was in my room, it was in the closet. Meantime, I had moved out of the room I shared with my husband into a room by myself so that I could drink during the night. He almost caught me once. I nearly had a heart attack. So I had moved out. I complained about his snoring very bitterly, and he couldn't prove whether I was right or wrong. So I moved out. And that was a nice setup. But I had a dream. We all do. And I had a dream about the perfect mother. Well, I had the little white house with a picket fence. I really did. And there are a few things that went with that. And one of the things was that a good mother would have the house all nice and clean when the youngsters came home from school. And she would have cookies baking, or just baked, ready to pour glasses of milk or ginger ale so all our young friends could come in. And this was something I wanted to do. I very much wanted to do. Much as I wanted to read them stories when they went to bed. I never did either. But I would go to bed night after night and say to myself, now tomorrow I'm not going to drink. Tomorrow I'm going to get up and I'm going to wash the breakfast dishes. I'm going to make the beds. I'm going to do the washing. I'm going to vacuum and pick up the living room. And then when all these things are done, I'm going to make cookies. And I'll be all nice and fresh and clean with my hair combed and lipstick on when the kids come home from school. And this went on for a long, long time, a daily dream. A daily nightmare, the way it worked out. And in the morning, I didn't forget this, and I still wanted to do it, except I was pretty tired. You can't do too much when you're very tired. And after everybody had left, and I started over to do those dishes, it's hard to do the dishes when you can hardly put them in the sink because your hand is shaking so. And if I had not already had a drink, and it would be very late in the morning if I hadn't had a drink by 8 o'clock, then I could always say, well, now, if I just have one, the shaking will stop, and then I can do all of these things. It's funny about alcoholics. We never learn a thing from experience about drinking. And so I would have the one. And, of course, once that had stayed down, I would have to have just one more, and then I was going to feel great. Do you all remember the magic in the next drink? Always the magic in the next drink. It was going to do whatever it was I wanted it to do. And then I would go in to make the bed. The dishes I couldn't do. They had to be put wait till later. And I'd go in to make the bed. And at 2 o'clock, I would hear a little voice saying, "Mommy, you haven't got a headache again." And I could die. I remembered nothing. I knew nothing. Since 8:30, 9 o'clock, whatever time it was, I went in to make the bed. And the bed made me. There didn't seem to be any way to stop this pattern. I finally gave up trying. And then I really withdrew so that I was spending all my time. They say alcohol removes everything until finally you're left with just yourself and the bottle, and then eventually just the bottle is left. I stopped just short of being just the bottle left. But I removed everything else, although I didn't lose them to all exteriors. I lost them from me. I moved into this room, and I stayed in there day and night with the door closed. The only time I'd come out of that room was at night after everybody'd gone to bed and I'd paced the floor. It was at that time that I'd eat, 2 fingers in a peanut butter jar, a piece of raw hamburger taken out of the refrigerator. My husband says he can't recall my having a meal for the last 6 months before I came to AA. I rationed myself on liquor. I had 1/5 of whiskey to go me from 7 in the morning to 7 at night, and one from 7 at night to 7 in the morning. If I dressed, I was dressed for 3 or 4 days or until however long it was, I don't know. To say the least, my memory is not very acute of these days. And if I was undressed in my uniform, well, it was a day uniform or a night uniform, whichever way you want to look at it. It was a pajamas and a dirty bathrobe, or it was dungarees and a dirty T-shirt. That was a big choice, but that was dressed or not dressed. And it took 3 days to change from one uniform to the other. I came to out of a blackout one morning, and God was so very good to me. One of my many Thanksgivings. So very good to me. Because he allowed me to see myself as I really was. I had not had a bath for I don't know how long because I had fainted in the bathroom once and hit my head on the wall, on the floor rather. And, you know, there's only one thing to do about that. You don't take a bath. I couldn't put my head down to wash my hair because I would get dizzy. I was living like no self-respecting animal would live. I don't like to tell this. It just happens to be the truth. And so when I came to out of this blackout for that one blessed flash, all of this I could see. And I could see the house and the state it was in, which I won't describe. And suddenly, this was the end of all my dreams. Of what I wanted to be, the kind of a woman. I was no woman, I was no wife, I was no mother, I was a nothing. And I was a horrible nothing. And I hated me. From the bottom of my toes, I hated me. There was nothing to live for. And I sat down at my kitchen table to try to figure out what was going to be the best way to do this essential job. Now, I wanted out, I didn't care. I really and truly, and I've never been afraid of death. And I wasn't afraid that morning. I'm not afraid of blood, bullets, anything. It was just what was going to be the best thing under the circumstances. And so as I sat down to think it over, again, God was good, because just one thing came through, just one. What about the kids? They were 8 then. And then I had a decision to make as to whether they'd be better off with this hopeless drunk for a mother or no mother at all. Meantime, I won't go to it, but there had been doctors, there had been psychiatrists, there had been clergy, there had been a lot of involvement in my trying in a backhanded way to get help. So I felt I was hopeless. I was convinced I was absolutely hopeless. But came the thought of the kids, and I thought, can I do this? Can I leave them this heritage? And if I don't, what heritage am I giving them? And I never made any decision. This is one of the many... many coincidences, miracles, whatever you call it, of AA. I call it God taking me by the hand because I didn't have any sense whatsoever, and I have no recollection of ever having consciously heard of AA. This was in 1955. And I did not know a thing about it, but I do know I went to the telephone and I called the first number in the telephone book. And I don't believe I knew what I was calling. I couldn't have looked any farther if I was looking for a number. And my sneaking suspicion is I was listening, wanting the sound of a human voice. This was what I was reaching out for, the sound of a human voice. And I got a human voice on the other end of that line. When the telephone was answered, this gal said, "My name is Peggy and I'm an alcoholic." The first number in the Boston telephone directory was simply AA, and that is what I had called. Peggy talked to me for quite a few minutes and asked me if I would see somebody, and I said I'd be delighted to. I didn't ask her too much. I got the idea very quickly that being an alcoholic meant having some kind of a problem with liquor, and I was sure I was having some kind of a problem with liquor. But what the whole business was, I didn't know, and I couldn't have listened very long anyway. I couldn't absorb anything. But I did say I'd see somebody. And so two gals came out, and I thought that she probably had gone out to the nearest skid row and got to dig up a couple of gals to come out to my house and see me. And when I looked out the window as they were walking up the walk, I realized I'd made a terrible mistake. She hadn't done that. She called in near a social agency. Two nice, clean-looking girls, charming-looking young ladies were walking up the front walk, and I thought, well, I didn't think I'd ever be turning to social workers, but I'll see what this is all about, and I sure hope they'll help me clean up the house. So with that thought in mind, I let them in. And that thought didn't stay very long. Ada started to talk to me. She didn't look around the house in the way I had been looking around the house. She didn't look at it at all. As a matter of fact, she looked at me. And she looked at me with love. And she looked at me with understanding. And she told me she was an alcoholic. And she told me that she a little bit about her story. She had children, too. And she had a beautiful story because she'd been an outside drinker, where I was just a little old stay-at-home stick-in-the-mud drinker. And she had really some fascinating tales to tell. And I looked at this gal, and I thought, this can't be true, what she's telling me. And yet I knew it was. It couldn't be anything but true. Finally, as Ada went on, she told me a little bit about AA. And I said, can I go? Would I be eligible? What do you have to do? And she said, all you have to do is be willing to stop drinking. Do you want to stop drinking? Yes. And I thought to myself, I'd just do anything in this world to be one half of the wonderful woman that she is. I'd do anything she tells me to, if I can just have that. This was something new in my life. Now I wanted something outside of myself, outside of the family, more than I wanted the next drink. I wanted to be like Ada, a power of example and hope she gave me that first day. I said to her, Ada, how do you get sober? She said, honey, you stop drinking. And I digested that for a minute, and then I said, now? And she said, yes, now. Then she said, we will help you. I didn't know what she meant. But it was a thrilling thing. I had not been able to speak to anybody, to go outside of the house, to do anything for myself. Nobody had been able to help me when I had gone looking for help. And now this gal, a stranger with love, was saying to me, we will help you. And help me they did. As I say, they didn't help me. They didn't clean up the house. They showed me how I could do it. They helped me get sober so I could do it. And it was much better when I could do it myself. So I started that very first day after they left. And she said, can you go the rest of the day without a drink? I said, I don't know. And she said, will you try? And I said, yes, I'll try. And I did try. And she told me that the following morning, or after she left that morning, she said, you're not going to have enough strength to do this by yourself. You couldn't before, and you can't now, and nobody could. I couldn't. And she said, what you do is, you ask God. She didn't say, you know, are we going to talk about God in front of her? Is it too soon to mention God? None of this. She said, you just ask God to help you stay away from the first drink for the rest of this day. And when you are successful, not if, when you are successful tonight, you thank him. And I did it. And I didn't have a drink that day, and I was mighty sick. And she called me umpteen times, and the other gal who came with her called me umpteen times, and they had every man and woman in the group and the surrounding groups calling me at 15 or 20 minute intervals, all day and all night. And they gave me messages like, we haven't met you, we're looking forward to meeting you, we'll hope we'll see you with the group. We've been through it, we know how you're feeling, is there anything we can do for you? Have you had any oranges? Are you drinking ginger ale? So with all of their help and walking the floor for 3 days and three nights, I finally managed to come out of the worst of that, and I went to my first meeting, and I met wonderful people like there are here. And at my first meeting, they have a book raffle in that area at every meeting, and the man in back of me won the book. And he said, is there a newcomer in the room? And I jumped out of my chair like this. I said, here! I didn't suddenly care whether anybody knew I was a newcomer or knew whether I was an alcoholic or knew anything. I had already discovered I was the only one in the room that looked like a drunk. But I knew something from listening to the chairman and the first speaker, and from something apparently that had gotten through to me when Ada had been there a few days before. Somewhere I'd gotten it into my head that all the answers were in this book. This book was it. It was the thing. You had to have the book. And if you got the book, and if you learned the book, you knew the answers. If you lived by the book, this was it. So when the book was offered and I found I could have it, I didn't even know then you could buy them. I thought you had to get them this way. So when this dear man gave me the book, I took it home. And you know something that hasn't changed a bit? The book. The answers are still in the book. And the answers are still for me in the book. And you know, I don't read the book the same way now that I did in 1955, the first time I read it. I don't read it the same way at all. And I don't read it the same way, any page on it, the same way twice. Every time there's something I can read it and it's fresh and it's new, and I say, I don't think I saw that before. Apparently I wasn't ready to assimilate it or try to use it. And that book means much more to me today, even than it did then. But it was that that got me started. And they said that it would be very wise for me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, and if you decide at that time that you're not an alcoholic, we'll give you all your troubles back on the way out. And so I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, and then I continued at approximately that same pace for 7 years. I fell in love with AA. I escaped into AA in the beginning, and I knew I did it. I did not want to clean up that house. I could not face the responsibilities that were there. My husband drove me up the wall when he came home and opened a can of beer every night. I had been used to fighting with him every night when he came home for so long so that I could escape before I did the withdrawal thing, that I was still in that habit, and I didn't want to fight with him. And I literally escaped into AA, and thank God AA was there to escape into. And it filled every need in the world for me. It was family, it was just everything. It was food and drink and rest and entertainment and social life and everything. It was all wound up in AA. And there were lots of meetings in the area, and I went around like a whirling dervish to all of them. And I remember the thrill as I walked into a meeting one night, the first person who called me by name said, hello, Midge, somebody knows my name. I didn't remember a soul's name, and I'm still terribly bad on that. But it was a very great thrill to me. And so my own AA life started in a wonderful way, and it's continued. I feel very much like Cinderella. I used to feel like one of the sisters, but I feel like Cinderella, and I have ever since I came into AA, and I think my life has been a Cinderella story since I came into AA. I think in our own way, each of ours is. And it hasn't gotten to be 12 o'clock yet. And I don't want it to get to be 12 o'clock. And I just don't believe it's going to, unless I pick up the first drink. If I can continue to stay away from the first drink each 24 hours, I don't think my 12 o'clock is coming. But it's right there. I know it's there. And I can turn right back into that pumpkin. And I prefer being Cinderella. I wanted to talk a little bit about Thanksgiving. And first of all, one of my Thanksgiving thanks is, there were some special things I wanted to say, so I did make headings here for myself. One of the very first things for which I'm thankful is that I'm an alcoholic. They say alcoholism is self-will run riot, and I was that at 3. So I think without becoming alcoholic, I would have continued on this same way if I had never had a drink. Self-willed, self-centered, opinionated, pretty objectionable. I don't think I ever would have learned how to communicate, how to get along with other people, had I not, first of all, become an alcoholic, because that is one of the requisites to be an AA member. And, of course, the greatest gratitude in my life and the greatest thanks for which I do give thanks every day I live is for the fact that I have had the privilege of becoming a member of AA. You know, there's that pamphlet, Who Me? And I change that a little bit when I think of being a member of AA. Why me? Why was I so lucky? Of all the millions of people that are out still drinking tonight that were drinking when I came in 1955, and have lost everything since that time, and I am here, and tonight sober, and tonight well, and tonight extremely happy. Why me? And then I read in the book of Acts, God is no respecter of persons. I say alcohol is no respecter of persons. And I like it this way a little bit better. God is no respecter of persons. And so each one of us, and I know I didn't merit AA, but God didn't think I had to merit AA. I just wanted something better. And so he led me to AA. I'm very thankful for that good husband that took care of me very lovingly while I was drinking. He didn't think alcohol was my problem. He thought I was going insane. He was about ready to have me committed to an institution when I came to AA, and he did not want me to come. I defied him in coming. I remember my words. The night that I was going out with my sponsor and her husband, he said, I wish you wouldn't go. And I snapped at him, and I said, John, I don't give a damn what you want. This is something I have to do for myself. I don't know where those words came from, but I knew it then, and so I came for myself. Since that time, he has been to literally hundreds of meetings with me, and he has never objected one bit to the many inconveniences he has had to put up with because of my AA activities, my AA job, and AA traveling. Never one word of complaint have I heard from him in any way. I wish he were a member of Al-Anon. He was not interested. You know, tried it once and didn't like it. He got his head chopped off by a biddy. And he wouldn't go back. And there's nothing I can do about that. He's very happy in his own little groove, in his own little way. But he's been very, very wonderful to me. And I'm very grateful for the AA program in helping me to bring up my children. When I got sober and they were 8 years old, I was no more capable in my sobriety of bringing them up than I had been when I was drunk, really. It was a very difficult adjustment for me, and it must have been for them. But we made it with the help of AAs and the help of God. And I can remember, I guess about 6 months after I'd come in one day, little Mark said to me, Mommy, this was a Monday, and he said, Mommy, can I go to the movies next Saturday? And he said, oh, that's a silly thing to ask you. You're going to say, how do I know? Wait till Saturday. We do it a day at a time. But a lot of those little things filled it in. Those boys are 23. They just had their 23rd birthday together in Vietnam. One of them is in the Army and the other in the Navy. My Navy boy had just gone to Vietnam. He's a medic attached to the Marines. And he had just been in Vietnam a short time. And I've never seen anybody so anxious to go any place in my life as he was to go to Vietnam, because he was going to somehow have his 23rd birthday with his brother. This twinship is something that's hard for us Earth people to understand, but it's very real. It's very wonderful. The other boy had been there and was almost finishing his year. So on the 13th of October, they managed to get together for 3 days. And I have a picture of them both there. And they're the happiest looking young men you ever want to see. I have finally been able to let them go. They are young men now. They're not my children as such. They're wonderful people, and I love them as people. And I respect and admire them as people, apart from my son, which is nice. I like this very much. The boy who was coming home has been the emotionally mature of the two all his life. He arrived home the 23rd of October. Having had so elated and tell me all about the birthday that they had together and how the twins changed uniforms and confused the Army, the Navy, and the Marines. He told me how much the day at a time meant to him while he was in Vietnam and how many times he thought of it. And that he was very grateful that he had learned a little bit to live this way while he was growing up. While he was there, he was engaged when he left. He got a Dear John letter while he was there, in the middle of his tour. He almost got shot by a sniper the night he got the letter because he was not alert. But he came home all in one piece safely. But to face this situation, the girl had not married anybody else. I still don't know what happened. I don't think he, but that's beside the point. The maturity with which this young man faced what was ahead of him and the way he has gone on after the year he has just had is absolutely incredible to me. But my sobriety, I think, has meant more to me in the last month than it has in all the rest of the time put together, because I was there. Even when I have been going to work, he's called me on the telephone. I have spent been able to spend quite a bit of spare time with him. We've talked things over a lot. We really communicate at depth, and we're awfully good friends. And he has shared so much of himself with me since he's come back. I have the greatest of admiration for the way he is living his day at a time now. And this is on my Thanksgiving list. And I was early in AA, 2 years in AA, I was pushed into service. I probably wouldn't have gotten there otherwise. I was sent in to be a GSR to represent the group at an assembly, and nobody in the group knew what a GSR was in 1957, but they had to have one. So they decided I was it, and I went in. I didn't know what I was going to, and I came home from that meeting with a big stack of books, having been an elected secretary of whatever this committee was, and I didn't know what the committee was. It was the State Committee of Eastern Massachusetts. And I had 2 years on the committee, and they never did get another GSR for the group. So it kind of doubled in that, but they didn't want to hear anything. Have you ever heard that? You know? So the group didn't take up too much of my time, my activities. But it was a very good experience for me. And I'm not going into any more of my other of this wonderful service experience, except to say that this just makes AA, believe me, service is the frosting on the cake. I don't think there are parts of the program. I don't think there's a spiritual side, a service side, a tradition side. I think we have a total program, and that you and I either use the total program, or we jip ourselves by taking a little cut of it and leaving the rest. Well, I still am a little piggy, and I want all of it. And the only way to get all of it is to use all of it. And we have all of us the privilege of using all of it. And so the very last service experience that we have all had. It's in your last box 459 for those of you who get it. And the things I'm going to tell you about aren't in there at all. It's the World Service Meeting, which has just taken place, and I'm just going to be very brief about this, but it was absolutely fabulous. It was unbelievable. I did have the very great honor, privilege, and I don't know how this happened. I don't question it. It did. Of being secretary of this meeting. Now, the meeting came into being over a period of about 3 years. It didn't just happen and come full-blown. It came into being. It was approved by our board. It was approved by the boards of all the countries who were coming. It was approved by our General Service Conference last year, and two delegates were elected from our General Service Conference. The money was allocated by the board and approved by the conference, and money was sent in by all the other countries. That to take care of briefly the background and the financial situation. Then the delegates, we had certain qualifications for delegates. One was they must be English-speaking, they could be trustees, AA or non-AA. They could have one non-AA and one AA from a country. They could have the person who was working in the office or somebody who was active in service or in publishing. And the various countries were invited, 13. And I began to get letters from them. The delegates were being elected. They were startled in some countries because they had some politicking. Some of those people wanted to be delegates so they could get a trip to New York. They turned out, without doubt, the finest group of AAs that has ever been my privilege to meet, service-minded, wonderful, wonderful people. One woman from Australia, Berenice, and a lovely, lovely girl. Two from South Africa, great men. The countries of Europe, France, England. I was very interested when the German delegate wrote, one of them wrote, and said that he was learning English so he could come. The French delegate said that he knew English, one of them. The other one didn't say anything. He didn't write. His friend did all the writing, although he did what it turned out happened to know some English. The Norwegians had a little English, but this was very difficult. It sounded almost as if I was making fun of them. Believe me, I'm not. When we said must understand English, they did understand English. They could read it and they could write it. They had a little difficulty in understanding it as we said it, particularly where all our accents may be a little different. And they had a greater difficulty if it wasn't impossible for them to say it, because spoken English and the sound of it was something that they weren't familiar with. Well, these people were all very excited, as naturally anyone would be coming to New York. We were having a reception for them Wednesday night as an icebreaker. Bill and Lois were going to be there, and they were. And I don't think, since I came into AA, I have ever been as nervous in my life as I was about 8 o'clock that night, standing there in the room, and everything was ready, and we had the flags around, and everything looked beautiful, and the table was set up with a guest book for them to sign, and the coffee was there. And I knew that in just a minute they would start to arrive, and I was a nervous wreck, not knowing. I mean, this was really going into something absolutely blind. None of us knew how it was going to work out. Well, that was at 8 o'clock. They came in. We introduced them one to another. They had their coffee. At 9 o'clock, you would have thought that was a swinging cocktail party. The delegates had come in pairs and kind of stayed close and hugged onto each other till they got their coffee, and then they said, "Phooey on you," when they went different directions. They mingled, they talked, they sat down at the table with Bill. They went around talking to people from various, where are you from, you know? What language do you speak? They got together talking French. The Frenchman, who was having a little difficulty with talking most anything, one of them, because of illness, was a replacement and had to come at the last minute, bless his heart. He couldn't speak any English, and he was over with a group talking Spanish. We had one Negro delegate from the United States, from Michigan, a wonderful delegate at both to the conference and the World Service Meeting, and a fine AA. I was a little concerned about him in a way. He was the only one. I wanted to be sure that he was comfortable. We also had two from South Africa. And the meeting was, the affair was going on. There was nothing, this was just a sit down, eat, and enjoy yourself deal and visit. And I couldn't find, Charles anyplace. And I thought, oh dear, don't tell me, you know, he went up to his room. I looked all around the room and I couldn't find him. And I was about to go and ask somebody where he was when I turned around the back of me and he was standing there talking to a man whose face I could not see. I just saw his back. So I walked around to see the face of the delegate that our Michigan friend was talking to, and it was one of the men from South Africa. And they became very, very firm friends. They stood there for an hour and a half to my certain knowledge talking, and they became wonderful friends. This is just, again, a dramatic example of the millions of little things that happened, but this is the kind of thing that happened throughout. The German boy who was learning to speak German, they had their papers all prepared ahead of time. We had them mimeographed, double-spaced in English so that they could read them. They were in a book about that thick, no exaggeration. Everybody had to read everything at this meeting so that everyone could follow it simultaneously to get the most out of it. And as the German boy came up to read, he apologized for his English, and then he started to read it. He had learned it phonetically, and he didn't even have an accent. Now, that must have taken an awful lot of love and work to learn to do that. Would you like to do that in German? We talked, first of all, about structure, about publishing, about finances, about literature, and about service. And we went through all those five subjects, presentations, and everybody at GSO participated and made a presentation on what they did. We had discussion groups broken up into small groups of six delegates at a table with one staff member. And we had a session with our board of trustees who only came in for the one session where they participated. We had all our meals together, sat with different people every time and mixed up. Much sharing of experiences of countries. How did you get your publishing started? How did you get your GSO office started? How did you get your conference started? And back and forth they went at these sessions. The upshot of it was that when they had their evaluation and future session on Saturday afternoon, they wanted to have another meeting. And this will obviously be a growing and a perpetuating thing now in 3 years. The next meeting will be in New York. After that, it is everyone's hope that it will move from country to country. This is now evolving into a world service body. This is not a policy-making body except for themselves. This is not an authoritative body. But here, much good AA work and carrying the message will be done. They now have their own committees. They have a policy committee, which is policy only for them, as our conference policy committee is. They have an agenda admissions committee, a finance committee, and a literature committee. The literature committee is going to be a very busy one discussing literature publishing and distribution in languages around the world. How many places should publish literature in Spanish and distribute it? I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know anyone who does, but it's a big question right now. And we hope that this body of people will get into and do the research and studying on these things. But we are going to have another one. And the grand finale was they were all invited to Bill's dinner at the Hilton Hotel, and Intergroup, in their wonderfully cooperative way with GSO, had a head table just below the head table for us. I mean, for their own committee. They had the head table for the World Service delegates. They had the hall decorated with flags. Every delegate, and there were 26 of them sitting up at that table, had the flag of his country in front of him, and up on the head table, there was one flag of New Zealand, because the New Zealand delegate was chosen as speaker, the opening speaker at Bill's dinner. And he got up and said, there are three times as many people in this room as we have in the AAs in New Zealand. But that means roughly 1,000 AAs in New Zealand, and he was the founder of AA in New Zealand and Alona 20 years ago. And he spoke at that dinner. There was not a dry eye in the house. At least I don't think there was. I couldn't see very well myself. But not only is this exciting and wonderful, but participate in, I think it's just as exciting and important for you. Because this is historic. This is a tremendous step forward in AA. This is a cohesion. This is a unity. On Monday, after the meeting, about 18 of them came over to the office to have, to talk to us. Well, we all met in the conference room and stayed in there all day and had a wonderful affair. During that time, I got up. For any of you who know our conference room, it looks over the East River in the United Nations building. It was a lovely sunny day, and I got up and saw the sun sparkling on the East River. And then I looked at the UN building and knew what we had just been through. And I thought, oh, if only we could give them at their Security Council and their General Assembly the love, the ability to communicate with a common purpose. They have a common purpose, but ours seems to be different, I guess. If only we could give them what we had seen happen, because we had seen the impossible and the miracle happen before our eyes with the communication between these people. And so that's on my Thanksgiving list, the wonderful growth in AA. And I'm thankful for the enthusiasm of every one of you and the enthusiasm of every AA, because it's only because your enthusiasm is contagious that I can maintain mine. And you know, I have never seen a really enthusiastic, and I don't mean something jumping up like a monkey on a stick the way I sometimes do, but I mean the regular, the just basically enthusiastic, keeping on going kind of a wonderful AA. And I've never seen that kind of a person get drunk. Never. And it's very seldom you see that kind of a person unhappy. Mostly they're too busy. But this enthusiasm is contagious. And so to maintain your own, help maintain your own sobriety and to help keep up my enthusiasm, please don't lose yours. I'm very grateful that through AA I have learned to love. When I came to AA, I thought I loved. I thought I knew all about love. I didn't know a thing. Not one thing. Because my family loved me, my husband loved me, my children loved me, my parents. And certainly all of you showed me all kinds of love when I came in. But I did not return it in any direction. I didn't know how. And this finally came to me. I finally realized this myself. And then I learned that love has to come from the inside out. I could reflect yours, but it was only bouncing off surface. It was not coming from within me. So very gradually, with God's help, I had to start to try and peel away the layers around my heart and open it to give to you and to receive you. And it was through the practice of the steps and a very loving sponsor who was a blind man, who became what I call my working sponsor, that I finally learned this, learned that it must be through the steps, when he said to me one night, "What's the matter with you? Have you been working on the steps?" And I said, "Oh, of course." He said, "Yeah, the first and the 12th. What else have you done?" And even though he was blind, I couldn't answer that one, because I hadn't been. And he said, "Midge, let me tell you something. As long as those steps remain words on a printed page, they're not going to help you one bit." And so I went to work with much help. And it was through this process that I finally learned, and I finally came to realize that all along there was a very loving and understanding God who had taken care of me all these years in spite of myself, and who had finally brought me to safe harbor. And it was up to me to work with him in love, to keep myself in safe harbor, and perhaps to have an opportunity to bring someone else into this same safe harbor. And I am so grateful for my loving God that through all of you I found. And so now from the bottom of my heart I can say to you, I love you. Happy Thanksgiving for you all. God bless you all.